Okay. I think we're ready. We're studying Matthew chapter 7. We're still focusing on the 21st through the 23rd verses. And last week we were speaking about the issue of money. And one of the reasons is because I think one of the great examples of the problem that we're reading about here in verses 21 through 23 involves the subject of money. If we think of the prime example the Lord has given us in the New Testament, which is Judas, he was a man that was obviously preoccupied with money. He was a thief. And it's interesting when we read this passage here, the Lord is talking about the subject of deception. He wants us to realize that there's tremendous depth to that verse over in Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And that deceit is such that you can think that you're saved and have a position that is in the high circles of religion and be just as lost as you can be. That to me is frightening beyond imagination. To think that a person could have such associations as the disciples did among themselves and the Lord Jesus as their teacher, and for that prolonged period of time of three and a half years, and yet Judas lost his soul forever. And all throughout the scripture, there is focus on leadership and the deception related to leadership. Every time you read the word Pharisee in the Bible, you're talking about people that were in high places as far as religion is concerned. And some of the strongest language found in the Bible is directed toward the Pharisees. And another thing is, it's interesting to ponder over the letters to the churches in the Revelation. And the Apostle John writes here in the second chapter to the Revelation, he says, "And unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich, and I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan." He's writing that to the people of Smyrna, and he's talking to them about the Jews who believe they were the people of God, just like Christians do sitting in church. But then we go down to verse 12, and it says, "And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things saith he which hath a sharp sword and two edges. I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is. And thou holdest fast my name and hast not denied my faith, even in the days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr and was slain among you, where Satan dwelleth." Folks, this is scary. Just because a person goes to a good church, that doesn't somehow or other give you some special refuge from the kind of dangers that we read about in this book. And so we could go on and on looking at some of these kinds of things, but last week, I was trying to bring out a point that I think is so important when it comes to seeing the ministry the way the Lord sees it, and trying to appreciate the example that he gave us here in the world. And we looked briefly at 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9 that has to do with the characteristics of the Lord's coming, how that he left the wealth that pertains to him. I mean, he is the creator of all things, and all the gold, the silver, the cattle upon a thousand hills, the hills, everything belongs to him. There's no way to comprehend wealth as we might humanly think of it as related to the Lord. But he chose to come down here without any of that. As a matter of fact, he came in poverty. Though he was rich, yet he became poor. He became poor. And I was offering a reason for that. And I was trying to approach it from the standpoint of human nature. And human nature is we're self-centered. And our relationships with the people around us, and even God, is to use them in whatever way we can, that it might be a personal benefit to us. And so human relationships are very much that way. They're very self-centered. And as long as there's a self-serving purpose to gain, in our relationships with people, then we'll nurture that relationship because of what we're going to get out of it. And that's the way we are. We're getters. Our whole orientation is getting. It's not giving. Giving is a virtue that is characteristic of God and issues out of his nature. He is a giving God. He's a loving God. He's a caring God. Man is not any of those things by nature. We love ourselves, and we think in terms of our own interests. We do not think in terms of the interests of people around us. And so it would be a stumbling block for the Lord to come with great glory and with the wealth that pertains to him as a person. Because the natural man would follow him for what they were going to get out of it. As a matter of fact, the Jews were really disappointed when Jesus came, because what they wanted out of him was deliverance from their enemies. And they thought that, you know, when the Messiah did come, this is going to be the first thing he would do. He would deliver them from their enemies. And then they could have, you know, peace. They could resume their normal lives and begin to once again pursue their goals. Much like what we see here in America today. People here in America today don't care a thing in the world about God. We've already proven that. We've outlawed him. All we care about is our own financial resources and getting back to a more economically stable system, so that we can continue to go out here and work and make money and pursue our goals. Again, it's just completely self-centered. It has nothing to do with God whatsoever. It has to do with man and what we want. And so the Lord became poor. And the reason is because all throughout the Bible, the Lord makes this absolutely clear. He loves us, and he wants us to be one with him. A completely, in other words, he wants us to have a relationship with him that was, I think, much like the whole point in the book of Job. Does the testing of Job had to do with whether Job loved the Lord for what he was getting out of God, or whether Job loved the Lord just because of him, just because he's good, just because he's worthy of our love. Folks, that's what salvation is all about. It's about coming to know the loving God personally, for no other reason in the world than to be close to him, to love him, to worship him, to spend eternity with him. Heaven is Christ. It's not a place. It's a person. And salvation is not a state of being. It's a person. And the Bible is written in such a way as to force us into that kind of relationship with God, where the only thing that matters is him. And so he came in this particular fashion of poverty, so that the natural man would not be in a relationship with the Lord for what they could get out of him. And I'm telling you, if he had money, if he had the treasures of silver and gold, we'd be after it in our nature. That's the way we are. It's the way we think. And it's a powerful thing in a human being. And I was trying to bring out the point that even in our relationships with one another, you get around people that are wealthy, and I'm telling you, your mind will go there. And if you're not careful, you'll be in that relationship for what you can get out of it. And them as a person is going to mean precious little to you as compared to this ulterior motive for what you can get out of them. And we ought to learn to loathe that, because it's wicked. It's absolutely wicked. And if we could just be honest enough to acknowledge that these things are true about our nature, which is wicked, then we might could have relationships with people that are eternally meaningful. I mean, think about it. Isn't it a wonderful thing to meet people that care about you, because that's the only reason for the involvement? They care about you as a person. There's just something that's offensive about somebody that has an ulterior motive for any kind of relationship, and it's offensive to God. When you look at the Trinity, you see the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and the fellowship and the love that are shared among the persons of the Trinity is pure, is perfect. And there's no other reason for the love that's there than just the persons themselves. And that's what the Lord wants in his relationship with you and me. As Paris Reedhead says, not for what we're going to get out of God, but for what God is going to get out of us. And what he's after in us is this kind of understanding. To love him with a pure heart for no other reason in the world than who he is, as illustrated in the book of Job. And that is the main point in the book of Job. Do you love God because he's given you a nice family with children and camels, cattle, goats? I mean, Job was rich. And so one of the first tests was to lose everything. And Job rejoiced in the Lord and acknowledged the fact that he came into this world with nothing. He would go out that way. And even though he had lost everything, blessed be the name of the Lord. And then when his very health was involved, it didn't change anything. Or he went through some troubles and some struggles and trials. But his relationship was still solid with the Lord. And he said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. What can you do against a man like that? If you're the devil trying to destroy somebody, that's the kind of relationship we need with Jesus Christ. That no matter what happens in life, we do not judge the Lord's relationship to us based on what he does for us. And if we lose everything that we've got and lose our health and we're dying and our bones are sticking out, that doesn't change the truth concerning what we know about the Lord. He loves us. But our hearts are so wicked, sometimes the Lord has to test these things and prove these things so that his very virtues begin to emerge out of our very souls as we worship the Lord, and we worship him with this very mentality and attitude of Job. As though he slay me, yeah, well, I trust in him. Folks, we need that. We need that kind of understanding, because if we don't, we'll be like a child that I talked with this past week in our school who lost a family member and had a bitterness because God had allowed this to happen. And he was judging God because of that. And you remember me telling you years ago, maybe some time ago, about a man years ago named Ray Simmons, who lost his child, drowned in a pond back behind the house. And he told my daddy, he said, I'll never get saved because I decided years ago that in my anger toward God because of what he let happen, I willed never to get saved. And this was his method of getting back with God. Folks, that's a horrible understanding of what we deserve. It's a horrible understanding of the loving God and the innocent God who is not guilty of anything. And when we begin to look at our affairs as though that what happens to us, whether we're blessed or whether we're losing, that is an expression of God's love toward us, that's a twisted way of thinking. And so if we understand these things, then when we come to the hard place, then we can put things in perspective and we can go through the trial and we can stay close by the Lord like Job and trust him anyway. Because whatever happens in life, it doesn't change the character of God. It doesn't change the love of God, the innocence of God, the justice of God, the righteousness of God. It's the same. He doesn't change. But we tend to judge him in terms of changes. That's a big mistake. I want to skip over some things here because I don't want to repeat a lot of things that we've already covered. But one of the things that we've looked at in terms of human nature is we've studied the scriptures and we've learned that every man by nature is an antichrist. We're born with an antichrist nature. If we read the Bible and we think of the antichrist as a singular extreme example of some unusual human being that's going to emerge that just in his warped way hates God and opposes God, then we're failing to see the Bible's message as it relates to you and I. We are all antichrists. As we've noted before, every personality that is mentioned in the Bible, every single one, in some way provides us a facet for looking at ourselves, whether we're looking at the Pharisees or King Saul or Balaam, Judas, Diotrephes, Alexander the coppersmith, Peter in his denial of the Lord. Every single example in the Bible provides us some kind of insight into what we're capable of put in the right set of circumstances. And so we need to be very careful about how we translate these things. And in our antichrist nature, one of the things that we discover as we read about the antichrist is how he's going to ultimately use wealth to gain his purposes. And Daniel chapter 11 goes into that, how he's going to have control of all the riches of silver and gold. And when we read about Judas being a thief, we're just looking at a small example of that same mentality in another human being. And as we're reading about Judas and his lust for money and his desire to get money, even by these means, is really a picture of all of us. In a lot of ways. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that you can think about yourself, and money is a powerful thing in the life of everybody. There's more friendships and things like that been destroyed over money than probably many of the other issues of life. Well, we see that the antichrist nature that is in everybody is seen in the extreme sense, again, in Daniel chapter 11, and how he's going to try to amass the world's wealth to be able to have global control. Brother Dan mentioned something last week that I think is very important, and that is the balance side of all of these thoughts. And we see it in the contrast between Judas and his attitude toward money and the Apostle Paul and his attitude toward money. The Apostle Paul had the life of Christ. And because he had the life of Christ, he had taken on to himself as a lifestyle the very fashion of the Lord Jesus and his lifestyle when he came into the world. Though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. The Apostle Paul was a highly educated man. He was a man that could have very easily held a very high position. Being a Roman citizen, being a Pharisee, of the Pharisees, schooled at the feet of Gamaliel, he no doubt had a level of education that was up near a doctorate. The man was brilliant. But I'd like for you to turn with me to Philippians chapter 4, because this to me is one of the most important passages for a Christian to think about and be familiar with. Let's just begin reading at verse 9. Paul writes to Philippians, "Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do. And the God of peace shall be with you. But I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again, wherein you were also careful, but ye lacked opportunity." And then he says these words, "Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned," a very important word. You see, the virtue that he's getting ready to describe is not natural. It's not installed in us from birth. The ability to do what he's fixing to say is not natural at all. It's supernatural in the extreme. And there's no man by nature that can say these things, but what he is really describing is the life that's now his. It's the life of Christ. Because this is exactly what the Lord did in his humanity. He says, "For I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content." Folks, that is wealth. This is the definition of wealth. You can't add to contentment. It carries the idea of coming up to somebody that has just finished a great big Thanksgiving meal. A car drives up in the yard, and somebody says, "I was just coming through town and thought I would stop by and ask you out to dinner. Can I take you over to the Lobster Inn and buy you a steak?" Amen. And you say, "Well, I'd like very much to do that, but I'm about to split at the seams right now with turkey and dressing and all the things that were on that table." Folks, I'm going to tell you something. You cannot add to contentment. Anything. I don't care how good it is. You cannot add to it. And Paul is saying here that he had learned to be content. And that is wealth. He goes on to say in verse 12, "I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed." Notice that word instructed. You need to put a circle around instructed and a circle around learned in verse 11. Because you learn this. You learn it from the Lord. You learn it in this revelation that has come to us from heaven that is about Him. And when we get saved, we receive His life. And when we receive His life, we receive His characteristics. We receive His virtues. And this is a virtue of God. It's not natural to be this way. But we ought to be this way. And so he says, "I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need." Now folks, when you've learned how to do this, then you're not going to complain. You won't be a complainer. You'll be able to say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord," whether you're abounding or whether you're losing everything. Job had learned how to do that. Somehow or other, in the course of his life, he had learned how to do that. Judas didn't. And so when you read these verses in Matthew chapter 7, and you're reading about people that are in the highest places of religion, and that's what we're reading about, you see. Have we not preached in thy name? We're talking about preachers. Have we not cast out devils in thy name? We're talking about people in high circles of religion. Have we not done many wonderful works in thy name? And Judas was a prime example of somebody at that high level that didn't have a clue about what Paul's talking about right here. And the reason is because he didn't have the life of Christ. He didn't want the life of Christ. He was too full of himself. He was too full of his goals and what he was going to do with the money that he was going to steal. But somehow or other, he had convinced himself that his taking was okay. I have known people that have gone to church all their life, sit around and talk to you about the Lord like an angel, and be embezzling money while they're doing it. Just because a person professes to be a Christian and looks the part of being a Christian doesn't mean that their heart has been converted. There's an inner man. There's a world that goes on inside of human beings that the world cannot see. And so really what defines you as a Christian is not what people see. It's what you are when they can't see you. That's what defines you. It's very important to understand that. Judas was a deceiver. And it's very possible to come to a place like Calvary Memorial Church and be involved in every kind of wickedness imaginable that you wouldn't dare let the people in the congregation know about that it's going on in your life, because this is the way we are. This is our predicament. We want to be in a religious circle because it's a good place to hide. But this kind of duplicity is a description of Judas and what this man's all about. He was a completely different human in the dark and behind closed doors. His whole life was radically different from what people were seeing. Now, we can't always protect ourselves from these kinds of people, because we can't see what goes on inside another human being. Paul wrote the Corinthians in the second chapter, and he said, "Who knows the spirit of a man save the spirit that is in him?" This is absolutely true. And so the value in being faithful to come to the meetings and to bother yourself to even come to Sunday school is because the Lord has put this thought in this Sunday school lesson for the benefit of anybody who might be doing this. It's God's way of speaking to you about things that no one else could possibly know about you, but God does. He knows all about these things. It's impossible for, yeah.
Context of, you know, found something that I want to get, and I'm going to use Christ to get it. I have to achieve this.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, this is fastened hard against these previous verses here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just radical.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Because, again, that's just a subtle way of using the Lord.
This is the other self, the other I that's saying this. Mm-hmm. This is the new man, and he's one of the men that lives in us.
Mm-hmm.
And this I says, I can do all things through Christ. It is through Christ, but it is the I that decides that you'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the victory. That's mm-hmm. the victory right
yeah. there. Well, it's kind of like people who say, I've prayed and prayed and prayed about it. A lot of people who say that have projected their own will into the will of God so that their will becomes God's will. And they can't believe that God doesn't think exactly the way they do about what they want. And so we create a God that thinks the way we do. Even in the details of our life, when it's things that we want, when people are not doing what we think they ought to do and all this kind of stuff, we're as self-centered as we can be. And it's the most subtle thing in the world. And we'll get down on our knees and we'll pray about this person that's so messed up and mistreating us and doing all this kind of stuff. And all we're trying to do is project into the mind of God that he thinks exactly the same way we do in our efforts to manipulate the circumstances on this planet so that our objectives can be achieved. And God is on our side. God is on our side. Slowly directing things toward that end. And that's just a very subtle thing, but I'm telling you.
Here's the other thing that comes to me about this is, here's the opposite, the other man that lives in us. He can decide, through Christ, I can be this other person. I am that other person. I will make this choice to be hungry. If I can, I might need to be hungry to the glory of God. I might need to be sick for the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
I might need to die for mm-hmm. the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do it because this is the new man talking.
Mm-hmm. And we have that ability. God gives us the ability to choose which person we want to be, which life we want to embrace. And that's exactly right. So most ministries are built on what man is going to get out of God, and technically what pastors in many churches hope to get out of their congregation. You see, the same nature that is in man in general is also in preachers. And many churches are built on this idea of bigness and getting. And we've got to get these members in here because the more members we have, the more money we're going to have. The more money is going to be put in the collection plate. The more money is put in the collection plate, the bigger building we can build. The more secure I can be in my salary. I might even be able to start my own retirement program. And so it just starts going this way. And folks, I'm telling you, this is a great evil. And it will get in the way. And it will turn ministries into things that have nothing whatsoever to do with God. It has to do with man and man's way of thinking. Now, I'm going to tell you something that's kind of interesting to me when I study out these thoughts. I believe that everything that is happening in our government had its starting point in the church. Everything. I believe that globalism as a concept began in the church. This ecumenism this emerging church that Brother Cloud speaks about. It's nothing in the world but globalism. It's a view of the world that is humanistic. And so what we see going on in our government, you can see going on in the church. Now, again, here in Matthew chapter 7, in the verses we've been reading, 21 through 23, the focus here is on leadership. I want you to think about something. Isn't it kind of interesting to watch the news about Fast and Furious and Attorney General Holder and how difficult it is to nail this guy? And how, no matter what the House of Representatives or the Senate does or says concerning these issues, they just seem to be paralyzed to get what it is that they want. And it's because these leaders, whether it be the Attorney General or the President, as is the case right now with the things that have happened in Libya, these people are in a bubble, and you can't get to them. And the whole idea is you can't speak against the president. You'll be investigated if you do. You can't protest and say anything negative about the president when he appears on the scene, this kind of thing. Or you'll have the vans, the black vans, headed your way to have a word with you. And you have to be very careful what you say publicly or in print about these people in leadership. But did you know that that had its origin in the church? I think it's very interesting. I've got a booklet here called O Timothy. It's published by David Cloud. And he's talking about Pastor Jack Hiles, the late Pastor Jack Hiles. He's put out a couple of these magazines about this, and I'm not going to speak about these things lightly. These are grave things. I know that it's a serious thing to talk about those that are believed to be men of God and all of that. But Brother Cloud is a person that I know personally. I spent some time talking with him. I know him personally. And I read his materials, and I've bought his books, and I read them, and I just love them. I appreciate the ministry that the Lord has given Brother David Cloud. And the truth is, I haven't got time to stand up here this morning and tell you the reasons why I do appreciate him so much. But I could stand up here for a while explaining why. But this man is vitally important in our day because he's very unique. He's very, very rare. And I'm telling you, he's a man of God, and he's anointed by God in what he's doing and what he's saying. And so far, I have not been able to find a way of refuting anything that he said in these articles, one of which has to do with Jack Hiles. I have met Jack Hiles. I have heard him preach on a number of occasions. He spoke at our Christian Educators Convention many years ago. I've heard him preach over at Berean Baptist in Fayetteville a couple of times. There's been several occasions where but I never got to sit down and, what you might say, know him personally. I just have been in services that are preached by him. But over the years, a man's thoughts and ways begin to be documented. And things begin to emerge out of their lives and so forth that people need to know about. And one of the things that people have been shocked of late to discover is the immorality that has been involved in his life personally and in his son's life. And the man's own daughter is coming out writing about these kinds of things and what went on. And it's a tragedy, and it's a great shame. But he wrote a book. Jack Hiles wrote a book called Jack Hiles on Justice. And we haven't got time to get into it because I just noticed the clock's up there at the ending point. But Brother David Cloud said concerning the doctrine as he presented it in this book concerning justice in the church as it relates to the pastor, is a perfect principle for a man-centered cult. Now that's strong. But what Jack Hiles did is he presented himself to his congregation through messages, through personal conversations, and through books that he wrote, literature that he wrote. He protected himself and put himself in a bubble where you could not judge him. No man could. And he said it. He said it. It's in his own words. And Brother Cloud has lifted out certain statements in his writings and has put it here for the world to read. And I have known some pastors over the years who have modeled their churches after Jack Hiles' philosophy of the church. Man-centered churches. One preacher that I know of personally was told by a pastor that was in that church before this particular pastor took over, told the associate pastor that if he didn't lead ever so many numbers of people to the Lord every week, he was going to replace him. That's a fact. That's an absolute fact. Because the idea is, if you're doing your job, if you're really led of God, you're going to see those professions of faith. You're going to see results. That's what Paris Reedhead was talking about in his message, 10 Shekels and a Shirt, the utilitarian philosophy that characterizes the church today. And so you've got deception in the highest places, and that's what Matthew chapter 7 is all about. Now, this is the Sermon on the Mount. The Lord is getting ready to close his sermon, and he's focusing on something that is so preciously important for us to understand and think through and get a handle on. He's coming to the end of his message. You see, this is when you start making your vital points. And he's bringing together all of the material that he's been bringing into this message from the Beatitudes and all of the different things that he's been talking about. And he's now coming down to his main point. And he's saying, you know, there's a ton of people in the church that think they're saved and they're not. And a lot of it is a result of the kind of church they're going to, where getting them come down the aisle, get them in the baptismal, getting the numbers in through whatever method you can use to do it, to build a church up, to build a church up. And so size and money is very central to all of this. And it has precious little to do with that individual out there and that person's spiritual relationship with Jesus Christ. The same bubble that we see around Jack Hiles and many preachers in this country is exactly what we're seeing in Washington right now with Eric Holder and our president. Those men ought to be scrutinized just like any other human being out here in the general public. And they are not above the law. They are subject to the law. And if they don't have something to hide, then they ought to come out in the open and realize that you don't have to hide anything when you are being truthful. But anyway, our time is gone. We've got to stop. Let's look to the Lord in prayer. Let's see. Craig, will you dismiss us, brother?